Fancy a game?
Technically correct.
Hard shell, soft shell, different types of meats, different types of cheeses.
With Tyler Bischoff.
Chaos.
On ESPN Las Vegas.
Will you be a lousy scab or will you be a man?
Hello, Irrelevance. That was ugly last night. UNLV lost to Texas State 64-57. A 7-point home loss to Texas State. Yesterday, we did talk about the possibility of UNLV losing to Texas State. Texas State came into that game ranked slightly higher in KenPom. UNLV, I think it was only a 4-point favorite. KenPom actually had them winning by 3 in that one. So losing isn't really a huge shocker. Not the big problem isn't that they lost the game. To me, the big problem is how the offense looked. They scored 57 points in that game. They were held under 1 point per possession by Texas State at home. Texas State is good defensively, but like they're good for the Sun Belt defensively. It's not like they're a defensive juggernaut compared to the rest of college basketball. They're a pretty average defensive team. So it's not like they're bad, but not going to sit here and pretend like Texas State is some excellent defense. The main problem for UNLV is exactly what we talked about yesterday for UNLV basketball. Finishing at the rim. UNLV could not do it. They were 10 of 26 on layups and dunks. That is 38.4% on layups and dunks. There are 55 teams in the country that are shooting better from three than UNLV shot on layups last night. 38% at the rim. That is atrocious. Like that's why they lost the game. Because UNLV got into the paint, they got into some high danger spots, but they had absolutely no ability to finish. And what happened in this game is Texas State's defense beat UNLV's offense in two main ways. The first way was with their ball screen coverage. Texas State used a hard hedge, and basically it's about as close to a double team or a trap as you can get, but the guy guarding the screener is going to stay with the ball handler after the screen until the guy guarding the ball handler recovers through the screen. So he's just staying with Amori Hardy or Elijah Mitru long as he has to. And what that leaves is the roll man's usually going to be open because his man is now running out to Amori Hardy. And so what it leaves is when you come off that screen, there's about a second, 2 seconds where your team has a 4-on-3 opportunity if you can get rid of the ball as the ball handler. UNLV didn't do that well enough. TJ Otzelberger said that he didn't think they looked to pass out of it soon enough, that they held it a dribble or two too long, too often when facing that type of defense. And then the other issue is when they did pass out of it, UNLV did a terrible job of exploiting the fact that they had a 4-on-3 for a couple of seconds. Mike Kramala came on this show last week and brought up the fact that he thought they were turning down open threes. Now that he's said that, I can't unsee it. Like, I feel like it happens all of the time now. That happened last night. There were chances for them to just pull a three when that's what Texas State left open, when a 4-on-3, and they didn't take it. But the more concerning part is there were multiple times from multiple players. Donnie Tillman did it a couple of times. Elijah Mitru Long did it where, let's say, Hardy comes off the ball screen, he gets the pass away, and now you have a 4-on-3, and players would just freeze with the ball. Like, they would have an opportunity, like, oh, there's nobody directly defending me, I can drive to the rim, and they would just freeze for a second, and Texas State would recover, and they couldn't do anything about it from then on. So Texas State was extremely aggressive with their ball screen defense, and UNLV couldn't exploit that aggression. That type of defense is inviting you to get 4-on-3s and get wide open good shots, and UNLV did a very, very poor job of exploiting that. The other problem UNLV had was Texas State collapsing in the paint. Their number one priority last night was stopping UNLV from getting layups. And all those missed layups, they were contested. They were not wide open layups. There were bodies and arms there. Texas State blocked 8 shots last night. 8. The most they have all season. More than they did against Baylor, which was somehow their other season high. Blocked 8 UNLV shots last night. So UNLV would still get into the paint, but then there would be 3 Texas State defenders there, and nobody on this team was good enough to actually finish over or around or through three Texas State defenders. And where UNLV failed was kicking the ball out. Their kickout passes were almost non-existent in the first 20, 30 minutes of that game. It happened a few times in the second half. Amori Hardy finally, it was like three Amori Hardy drives in a row where he drove and saw they were collapsing, kicked it out for a three. I think UNLV missed all three of those threes. But that was the other big problem for UNLV is they shot 38% on layups. They were pretty much all contested layups. They didn't do a good job of kicking out to guys for open threes or finding a teammate somewhere else to come cutting in for a layup. That didn't happen enough. So the defense could just simply collapse on UNLV when they got into the paint, and that gave UNLV a ton of issues. The other big problem for UNLV, they can't shoot. Amori Hardy, over the last two games, 7 of 11 from 3. Amori Hardy, that's excellent. That's about as good as you can ask anybody to shoot over two games from 3. Everyone else on the team over the last two games is 6 of 30 from 3-point range. That's 20% from 3-point range. So everyone not named Hardy can't shoot at the moment. Jonah Antonio didn't play last night. He has a left hand injury, according to TJ Otzelberger. He is day-to-day. They hope he'll play on Saturday. But UNLV doesn't have shooting at the moment. I think it'll get better. Donnie Tillman, Division I, Pac-12, shot well last year at Utah, right? He should be better than he is. I think he was 1 of 5 or 1 of 6 last night from 3. Like, he should be better than that. Elijah Mitrulong probably should be better than what he's hitting at the moment, but he's not necessarily a great shooter. So they should get a little bit better, but I don't know that they have great shooting. And when you sort of think about the construction of this offense at the moment, Amori Hardy's the primary creator. He's also the only one that can shoot right now. So when Amori Hardy drives into the lane and there's three defenders collapsing, who is he supposed to kick the ball out to? Because nobody else on the team can shoot at the moment. So it's not a great setup for UNLV, because I almost feel like all of Amori Hardy's threes that he's made have been him off the dribble shooting them. Like, it's not like somebody else is creating it for him. He's sort of creating them himself. So we'll see if UNLV gets better shooting. To me, they're in a situation where Jonah Antonio is like if he's healthy, he has to play like 30 minutes a night, even if he's not shooting well, simply because the threat of Jonah Antonio might change the way defenses play you. Like, if Jonah, and Otzelberger even mentioned this last night, if Jonah Antonio's out there, they probably don't collapse as much as they did, because at the very least, even if Jonah Antonio is coming off a 1 of 7 shooting performance, at the very least, his scouting report is shooter. His scouting report is, we don't leave that guy. We don't help off of Jonah Antonio. Whereas the scouting report for Bryce Hamilton or Elijah Mitrulong or Nick Blair or even Donnie Tillman right now is, yeah, you can leave that guy. He's not going to hurt us that bad. With Jonah Antonio, that's at least on the scouting report. It's at least in the mind. Even if he doesn't actually make the threes in a certain game, it's at least the threat and will open up the floor a little bit more. So as much as Otzelberger brings spacing to this offense, and we've talked a bunch about it, there's been some times where the spacing's been a little bit off. I think it's mainly a Nick Blair problem. But there's been times where the spacing's been a little bit off. But for the most part, the spacing is good this year. But it doesn't matter if nobody can shoot. You don't have to respect the spacing as a defense if everyone not named Amori Hardy is shooting 20% from the floor. So those were their big problems on offense last night. Here's a depressing fact for you. UNLV currently ranks 322nd in the country in tempo. There are 353 college basketball teams, almost in the bottom 30 for tempo in college basketball. I honestly, though, don't have a big problem with it right now. The only issue with it is that Otzelberger came in talking a lot about how much they run and how much pace they would have, and we ate it up and talked about it too. Get shots in the first 10 seconds of the shot clock, 3 seconds to get into a good scoring position, right? That to me is the only real problem with that, and they're not anywhere close to doing those things with this team. But the reason I'm not overly concerned with their tempo for the long term of the Otzelberger era, A, They've played six games. Five of their opponents are in the bottom 100 of tempo. Purdue-Fort Wayne is the only fast team that they've played this year. So a lot of this is opponent-driven. It's very hard to speed up a slow team. It's much easier to slow down a fast team. So a lot of this is opponent-driven, where you've played Mick Cronin and Mark Fox, coaches that are like, ah, yeah, we're going to play six possessions in this half. Does that sound good? Like, that's sort of how those coaches coach, and UNLV's gotten dragged into that. They're not good enough to impose their will on other teams, so they can't really speed up UCLA. They can't really speed up Kansas State. It's not going to happen. They can't even speed up Texas State. The other issue, though, is that UNLV doesn't have great talent as far as pushing the ball in transition. Like, I think if you look at the team, Amori Hardy's shown us over his career some moments where he's pretty good in transition. Bryce Hamilton has shown us a few in his short time. And then we just sort of expect that Donnie Tillman, he seems to have the skill set that he would be pretty good at it. But I wouldn't say any of them are excellent at it. I wouldn't say any of them really truly excel in transition. So, and then outside of those three, like, Elijah Mitrulong hasn't proven to be a very great transition point guard. Nick Blair isn't doing a whole lot for you in transition. Zhang's not doing a whole lot. I guess Antonio maybe, but his transition is, I'm going to run to the three-point line and everybody else has to get up and get the ball to me. So there's not a lot of players on this team where you're like, oh yeah, he'd be great in transition. And then what Otzelberger mentioned last night. It's about defense. UNLV, the best way to get out and run is to force a live ball turnover, because then you're in transition pretty much right away and you can get 3-on-2, 2-on-1s, or breakaways. That's the best way to do it. UNLV is average right now at forcing turnovers. They're not forcing a ton, but it's not like they're terrible at forcing turnovers. So they're not really getting a lot off of that. The bigger problem for UNLV is rebound. And simply put, you're not going to get, 1-on-0 breakaways off of defensive rebounds. Usually, you're not going to get 1-on-0 rebounds off of breakaways off of defensive rebounds. But when you get a defensive rebound, as opposed to giving up a shot that goes in, you can get a quick outlet pass up the floor, and you can be up the floor attacking the rim within 3, 4, 5 seconds. UNLV right now is 210th in defensive rebounding percentage in the country. 210th. Like, they're not good at rebounding on the defensive end. They're actually very good at offensive rebounding, but they're not good at defensive rebounding this season. You can't end a possession if you don't get the defensive rebound. The other team gets another shot at it. And if you go back and look at T.J. Otzelberger's South Dakota State teams, last year they were 6th in the country in defensive rebounding rate. The year before that, they were 17th in the country in defensive rebounding rate. So in the Summit League, South Dakota State was like the most dominant defensive rebounding team in that conference, and that'll makes it easier to get out and run. And right now, they're not doing that. They're not getting enough defensive rebounds or turnovers to get out and run. So I don't think it's going to change much this year. Like, they'll play faster simply because they're not playing Mick Cronin and Bruce Weber and Mark Fox every game the rest of the way. So they'll get faster throughout the course of the season. But I don't think this is not going to be a year where UNLV plays very fast. You're looking towards next year and the years beyond. You're hoping Otzelberger's bringing in six-player recruiting class. You're hoping that team can rebound, right? You're hoping that team becomes the dominant rebounding force that Otzelberger's South Dakota State teams were. But ultimately, this year is going to be slow, and it's going to hurt a lot of people. A lot of people are going to be annoyed with it. And you have the right to be, because Otzelberger came in talking about how fast they were going to play, how many points they scored at South Dakota State. They're not delivering on it in year one, but it's also year one. So it's like, if we're into year two and they're still 322nd in tempo, then it's like, all right, what the hell are you doing?
I saw a really interesting stat on Twitter.
And it wasn't from me?
His first year at South Dakota State, he was 222nd, and then his second and his third year.
Oh, it was for me.
Yeah, you killed my joke very efficiently. But anyway, yeah, he went up a level, and it's not translating immediately. Well, even at the previous level, it didn't translate immediately.
Yeah.
Year two is when everything came together.
Yeah, so I will say that first year at South Dakota State, he won the Summit League tournament and went to the NCAA tournament, so that if he does that here, he's going to buy a lot of goodwill as far as the fan base goes. But they've played six games, and it's not a ton of people because there's not that many people at the games, but There are a handful of people on Twitter that are genuinely pissed that UNLV is playing as slow as it is right now. And I don't necessarily blame them because, again, Otzelberger came in talking about how fast they were going to play, and they're not doing it at the moment. I don't really blame him based on the team, but when you say that the entire offseason, it's kind of like, all right, now you're not delivering on it at all, even if it's not entirely fair to do that. Technically Correct, brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Go to BeConnectedSports.com to download the mobile sports app for quick and easy betting from your phone or tablet. You can bet before the game or while you watch with in-game wagering. It is the BeConnected Sports app from Boyd Gaming.
Check out the podcast on LVSportsNetwork.com.
Hey, it's Tyler Bischoff. The best spot to place your bets is the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook. But if you're looking for even more convenience, download the BeConnected Sports app from BeConnectedSports.com. The BeConnected Sports app makes it easy to place bets from your phone or tablet and allows you to bet during the game. So download the BeConnected Sports app and you can be just a few clicks away from betting on the biggest games whenever you want. Boyd Gaming has you covered at the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook or at BeConnectedSports.com.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants.
No, I don't want to go to a party in your pants.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants!
Bischoff's Briefs.
Very well.
Marc-Andre Fleury got Mike Babcock fired.
The Maple Leafs fired Mike Babcock yesterday. It was approximately 12 hours after Marc-Andre Fleury went diving across the crease to make a save in the third period to prevent the Maple Leafs from tying the game. If Marc-Andre Fleury doesn't make that save, the Maple Leafs probably tie the game, probably at the very least get an overtime loser point, and Mike Babcock might have survived at least another day as the head coach of the Maple Leafs. But here's a fun fact for you. Since the Golden Knights entered the NHL, Mike Babcock led the Maple Leafs to 227 points in 187 regular season games. Gerard Gallant has led the Golden Knights to 227 points in 187 regular season games. So two seasons and 20, what is that, five, four games in? And Mike Babcock got fired for having the same exact record as Gerard Gallant. Playoffs are a little bit different, but it's not like Gallant won the Stanley Cup. My real point is you shouldn't have fired Mike Babcock.
Oh, okay, because I was going to make a different... I was me moving on was purely because I was like, can't make any of these jokes, so I'm rolling on. LaMarcus Joyner did not practice yesterday.
So the Raiders defensive back... here's the other thing. It was a walkthrough, but the NFL requires teams to submit an injury report based on practice. So when teams have a walkthrough, they send out an estimation of if a player would have practiced or not, and they estimated that LaMarcus Joyner would not have practiced yesterday. Very dumb. Very, very dumb. But Joyner did not play last week. It was the Bengals, so it didn't end up mattering that much. But Joyner is one of six Raiders this year that has played 75% of the defensive snaps for the season. He didn't play last week. Carl Joseph is another one of those Raiders. Carl Joseph is done for the season, also didn't play last week. So they only had four of their top six used defensive players last year. They've also had 19 different players play at least 100 snaps on defense this year. It's almost enough for two at every position.
Everyone's well-rested.
Yeah, maybe. We'll see how important or how much they need Joyner for Jets and Sam Darnold, but I think you're really looking to next week when they play Kansas City and Patrick Mahomes. That's when you need as many healthy, good, or maybe possibly they could be average defensive backs. Like if you don't have LaMarcus Joyner and you lost Jonathan Abram in the first game of the season, you lost Carl Joseph, and now it's like, all right, go pick off three more passes, Eric Harris. I don't know if that's going to work.
All right, come on, Eric Harris. The Texans host the Colts tonight.
Raiders need a cheer for the Texans. Texans and Colts both tied at 6-4 in the AFC South. Because the Raiders beat the Colts but lost to the Texans, you want the Texans to run away with the division because you can't win the AFC South, but you can win a wild card spot. And one of these teams, whoever loses this game tonight, is pretty much looking at playing for a wild card spot the rest of the year, you'd rather it be the Colts, because if you finish tied with the Colts, you have the tiebreaker and would go to the playoffs. Whereas if it's the Texans, they have the tiebreaker and you would not. Just last week's a good example. Raiders went into last weekend in a playoff spot. They won, but they are no longer in a playoff spot. It's because the Colts and Texans switched who was winning the division. And now the Texans are in the wild card race, and the Texans have the tiebreaker, kick the Raiders out. So you want the Texans to win tonight, and you want the Texans pretty much to win the rest of their games. Just go win the AFC South. It doesn't really matter what they do as long as they win the AFC South. And then, okay, now you can deal with the Colts. By the way, this is just excellent in general that we're doing this, because it's week 12, and we're talking about other teams' games and how it relates to the Raiders making the playoffs.
Content.
It's wonderful. Like, it's just, like, I wish that was part of our show for UNLV basketball. I wish that was part of our show for Lights FC. We kind of forced it with Lights FC because it was like, they win their last five games, they got a shot. But I wish that's what we could do for the other teams, is like, hey, not only are your team's games important, but other teams' games are important too for you to make the playoffs.
The Golden Knights rink in Henderson will be named Lifeguard Arena in Henderson.
If you remember, the Golden Knights are building an ice rink in Henderson. When they announced it, if you remember, they had a placeholder name for it, and the placeholder name was Vegas Golden Knights at Henderson. And at first, we had like a day-long period where we thought that was going to be the name of the building, and we were like, that's a terrible name for a building. Just Vegas Golden Knights at Henderson. I think they got it worse. What is Lifeguard Arena? So the company that's paying for the naming rights is a company called BT Supplies. And according to their press release, they have a new entity called Lifeguard Industrial and Home Supplies.
Okay.
And they supply home supplies to businesses.
All right.
I don't know where Lifeguard comes in. It didn't say anything about them providing lifeguards or lifeguard equipment at all. But the whole point of a naming rights deal for the sponsor is to get name recognition. Is so like, hey, the Golden Knights are playing at T-Mobile tonight. Everyone knows what the hell T-Mobile is. And you don't have to, but you say T-Mobile almost every time you talk about a Golden Knights home game. It's going to be the same for the Raiders and Allegiant. It's the same for City National Arena where the Golden Knights practice. People are just going to be confused when they're like, hey, we're going to skate at Lifeguard. You're what? What's that for?
Is there a pool that's frozen?
It's just going to be very, very confusing. I don't understand how this helps BT Supplies. Like, nobody's going to know what they are.
This also is, you named your product after another thing that already had a name. Like, what meeting room did someone go, oh, we're going to name this thing a hot dog? What does it have to do with hot dogs? Nothing.
Not at all.
But we are going to name the stadium Hot Dog Arena.
So what you're saying is the Aviators should consider renaming their ballpark Hot Dog Ballpark.
I mean, I would at least consider it.
I think it'd be better than Las Vegas Ballpark that's not in Las Vegas.
Doug Brumfeld is committed to UNLV regardless of who is coaching.
Mark Anderson of the RJ talked to a few UNLV football commits. Brumfeld is a quarterback out of California. He is, according to 24/7, the third best player in the class. His quote to the RJ, I'm pretty locked into UNLV 100%. The situation is out of my hands. There's nothing I can do. We all want to play football for Coach Sanchez, but if it's not him, it'll be for whoever is the coach in the future. If you're a UNLV fan, that is excellent news, and you hope that all of UNLV's commits have that same mindset. The good thing about Doug Brumfeld saying this is that he and two teammates from high school committed to UNLV kind of together. So if he's saying that, there's a good chance the other two, they're all going to stick around, even if Tony Sanchez gets fired and a new coach comes in. Granted, the new coach might have a say on whether or not these guys stick around, but we talked about it, last week? The timeline here for UNLV firing their coach and the early signing period, which is December 21st, 2nd this year. UNLV is going to have approximately 3 weeks from when, if they fire Tony Sanchez after the Nevada game, to when that early signing period is. If the coaching search takes a week, 2 weeks, that new coach is going to have an entire 10 days Before the early signing period. So you want your, it's going to be best case scenario if you keep together most of, Sanchez has 11 commits. If you keep most of those guys, that's probably best case scenario for this recruiting class.
Basically, I was going to agree and go, I don't know if this is going to go. Like, I don't know if they're going to have it before the early signing period.
The coach in place. So, again, assuming Sanchez does get fired, that's got to be one of the questions that, that I asked Desiree Francois is about, like, how does the early signing period impact your coaching search? Like, do you, is that a deadline that you basically have to put on yourself, that you've got to have somebody in place? Because, again, you're gonna, if you go through that early signing period without a coach, like I'm talking about, if they get one in a week or 10 days before, if you don't have one by then, that's pretty rough. Like, that's going to be pretty devastating. The other part to consider is a lot of times if they hire a coordinator, a lot of times those guys stick around and coach the bowl game. If you're UNLV, you're kind of telling, if you hire a coordinator, you're probably wanting to tell them, no, you got to leave. Like, you got to come coach us now. You got to come recruit now. You got to come get guys signed now. You can't stick around and coach whatever stupid bowl game you're in.
Okay. Hidden third option. You have him coach the bowl game, and then he starts looking for transfers while at the bowl game.
Just from the other team?
Yeah, just like walking up to the other team going, hey, man.
How's Las Vegas sound?
You like Las Vegas? I know she haven't got a lot of playing time here in this bowl game.
Your jersey's not even dirty. Bob Scucci from Boyd Gaming joins us next. We'll find out if anybody out there is betting on UNLV basketball.
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at @Bischoff_Tyler. Time to get an update from the sports book with Bob Scucci.
Bob, after they defeated Liberty by 10 points, Rutgers actually won a game. We still got 2 weeks until they take on number 3 Ohio State. You said 44. What's the line at?
40. I'm going to stick with 44 for now. I'm not going to change too much, especially with the big win over Liberty. It raises their stock.
Brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
Bob Scucci from Boyd Gaming joins us now. We get Golden Knights and Sharks tonight. You guys have any props up for an Evander Kane-Ryan Reeves fight?
We should. Boy, I'd make Reeves $1.50 favorite to win that fight.
How would you determine the winner of a hockey fight? Because they often, it's not like somebody gets knocked out usually. It's just sort of somebody falls because they're on skates.
Yeah, I think it's how many good punches somebody gets in. I mean, you can get in a bunch of good punches and be the first one to fall, so I don't think that you should be the loser of that fight. If you get some good shots and some clean shots, I think that determines the winner.
So we need judges. Yeah, we got to go to judges for hockey fights, is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, very important. What about the actual game? What are the Golden Knights favored by?
They're a pretty big favorite. They're $1.80 favorite over the Sharks.
And they've won 2 in a row. I know we talked last week about how they had lost like 6 of 7, whatever it was at the time. I assume just simply winning 2 in a row is enough to sort of put them back in the conversation of, all right, we got to make them heavy favorites all the time.
Yeah, like I said, even during that stretch, I think the opinion was, okay, they're just having a bad run, and eventually they're going to get their legs underneath them again, and then they're going to be back up to form. I mean, neither one of these teams are the teams they were last year at this point in the season, but we expect them to have their little down cycle, and they'll get back up to form.
If we look at college football, how far under did UNLV and Hawaii go last week, since it was only 21-7?
Let's see, 20, 30, about 30 points under. 35 points.
So we only needed, 5 more touchdowns for that game to be close to the over-under.
Exactly. See, if you got extra credit for going way under, there's some point bets out there that you could actually win more money by going really far under your wager.
So I'm going to make the assumption you guys had a lot of money on Hawaii, and Hawaii covering in the fourth quarter was not good.
It was one of our worst Saturdays, to be honest with you, of the season. So many popular favorites covered, starting with Michigan in the morning. And being that was a late game at night, all the parlays were coming in on the favorites. So them covering was pretty bad for most of the sports books.
Didn't Rutgers covered over Ohio State, though, didn't they?
Absolutely. If I hung that 44 like I wanted to, we'd have cleaned up. They scored 21 points, which is about 14 points more than we thought Rutgers would score.
Bob, would UNLV football be a favorite against Akron or UMass?
At this point, I don't know that they'd be favorites against too many teams. No, if they're at home, they would.
Okay, so
they need to be home.
So only at home against Akron and UMass, because UMass was the team that Northwestern was favored by, like, what, 39 points, and Northwestern had not scored 39 points in a game yet this season.
Yep. Right. No, exactly.
Granted, Northwestern is the only team, or UNLV is the only team Northwestern scored 30 on before that game. So that makes sense.
And Akron had a 0-yard punt.
Wasn't that by a quarterback though?
It's still 0 yards.
It's quarterback. He's not supposed to be punting. Calm down over there. For college football, sort of big picture question, what would be sort of your rankings or who would be favored of these four teams on a neutral field? Georgia, Oregon, Oklahoma, Alabama.
I still have Alabama favored over Georgia, Oregon, and Oklahoma. I think just, you know, that game, they weren't decisively defeated in their one loss. That was a great game against LSU, and we had Alabama favored pretty sizably over LSU, which means that they'd be favored over pretty much everyone in the country right now, with the exception of LSU.
So but that's with Tua, right?
That's with Tua, yeah.
So without him, would they still, like, how much of an adjustment would you be making?
Probably about two and a half, three points. It's a little bit different, yeah. Probably about at least 3 points.
So just from your personal opinion, would you, as somebody who, like, okay, you're making odds and you're like, yeah, Alabama's still one of the four best teams in the country, but they're not going to end up playing for an SEC title. Like, would you prefer to see simply the four best teams that you think, or do you think there's more to, like, the merit of earning it by winning your conference and stuff like that?
I think there's more to the merit of winning your conference. You know, there was a while back, we actually used to have a bookmakers poll, and it was actually pretty close to being considered when they were still determining, like, national championships, and they wondered if kind of a consensus of bookmakers would carry enough weight to say, okay, this can be another poll that you look at, because these teams would be favored, and if they'd be favored, that means they're the better team. But I think there's something to be said about winning your conference, and if you have the one and two teams that are kind of in the same conference and they have to play twice, you know, then so be it. I think it's kind of interesting the way it is now. I have no problems with it.
Is there any school that claims a national title based on this bookmakers poll?
Not to this point, no.
Okay, so somebody's going to dig one up. It was Alabama and Texas A&M a few years ago. They were digging up old national titles saying, look, this random poll named us number one. So somebody's coming eventually to say, look, Bob Scucci had us number one back in 1995. We're claiming that.
Right, no, exactly. But, I mean, with Alabama, they can't play for the championship, unless crazy things happen, but we still have them favored over just about anybody, so that means that they're still a great team.
So if we look at the NFL, we've got Raiders and Jets this weekend. How much are the Raiders favored by in New York?
3 points.
3 points. Okay, so that doesn't, I don't know, it doesn't seem like a lot, but it is on the road. Where's the money at for that one?
It's coming in on the Jets. It actually is kind of a lot. If you think about it, you know, where these two teams were at the beginning of the year, and for the Raiders who didn't draw a whole lot of support this year, and for them to suddenly be, you know, 3-point favorites on the road. I mean, I know it's against a pretty bad Jets team, but this Jets team hasn't looked too bad in the last couple of weeks. So, now the Raiders find themselves at 6-4 and kind of still in the hunt for in the division. So, this is setting up to be a pretty interesting game, but the money right now is coming in on the Jets.
If you let us assume that the Raiders win this weekend and they get to 7-4 and they set up a 7-4 versus 7-4 game in Kansas City next week, what's the line for that one?
Kansas City is still going to be pretty big. I'm probably making it somewhere around 7. They're going to be about a touchdown favorite, and I'd imagine people will still lay the favorite in that one.
I still love Patrick Mahomes, even if he
absolutely,
what did he throw for, 180 yards on Thursday night or Monday Night Football?
Yeah, no, they love betting on the Chiefs.
Packers and 49ers Sunday Night Football. What's the line for that one?
we keep bouncing back. Right now, it's San Francisco's a 3-point favorite. Great action both sides, but unfortunately, we keep bouncing from 3.5 to 3. So at 3, they're laying the 49ers, and every time we go to 3.5, they take Green Bay with 3.5. So that tells you what everybody thinks about how close this game will be played and how valuable that extra half a point is going to be in this one.
So 49ers by 3 or 3.5 basically means you guys view these teams as pretty similar?
Yeah, you know, on a neutral field, we'd probably give San Francisco like that half-point edge, so very, very slight. But basically, they're about the same in the power rankings. You know, San Francisco had the one chink in the armor with the close game against Seattle, but we've had Green Bay ranked pretty high all year, too. So this sets up to be just a great game and kind of a throwback to when these two teams were kind of fighting it out in the 90s.
We got Cowboys and Patriots, too. Is this going to be, like, the biggest handle for a regular season game ever?
It's a little different. I mean, right now, Green Bay and San Francisco is drawing every bit of action. Yeah, so it's pretty close. It's neck and neck. But I think that the point spread separates this one. I think, you know, New England at 6.5, it's just high enough where it slows people down from betting on New England. And Dallas has been drawing so much money from the public that seeing plus 6.5 actually looks pretty attractive. So we're getting pretty good two-way action on this, slightly heavier on New England. But like I said, I think the point spread just slows them down just a bit.
If we end with some UNLV basketball, they played Texas State last night. How many people bet on that? And please tell me it was like 6.
Yeah, there weren't many at all. I think UNLV was a 4-point favorite in that one.
So is what's going to happen? They play SMU on Saturday. It's a little bit bigger name of opponent. Like, will that help draw any more action to it?
It will, especially since SMU just beat Evansville on a buzzer beater. And then and Evansville is the team that knocked off a number one Kentucky as a 20-point underdog. So if you look back at some of it, it sets up to be a little bit more interesting. And it's going to be a tough one because of that. You know, SMU is coming in 4-0 right now. And like I said, the big win over Evansville. So it should be a pretty interesting game.
Did you have anyone that had bet the money line on Evansville against Kentucky?
I did not. I'm not sure. I'd have to search around some of my colleagues and see if anyone took a money line bet on that one.
Do you remember what was the line in that one?
I want to say 25.5.
Okay. Do you guys even offer money line bets for those?
Typically that high we don't, because I mean it's just so prohibitive. But certain operators, you know, will put a line on anything, and I'm not sure anyone had that up.
All right. Completely go different direction. What would the line be on a prop that Phillip Rivers will be down a possession with under 2 minutes to go?
He is a $2 favorite, minus $2, and then he's probably about $1.50 to throw an interception or a pick six on that last play.
Can we get that put into all Chargers in-game play?
It's going to come with every game for the rest of the season. You're going to get the game, the money line, and then whether or not he's down on that last possession in the fourth quarter.
I think it was Phillip Rivers has 61 losses by one possession or something like that in his career, and it's the most since he's been in the NFL. It's kind of unbelievable.
It really is. It's insane. I mean, it was like deja vu all over again.
Like we've talked before, you know, about NFL and one possession games and how you guys expect it to sort of even out either within the year itself or over to the next year. It almost never evens out for the Chargers. They're just always, they were 3-8 in one possession games every single year.
Yeah, we might have to be the year 2035 before it evens out after all these games.
So a Chargers dynasty is coming as soon as Phillip Rivers retires.
Exactly. He's like one. He's an enigma. You know, he's got so much great talent, but I mean, he just—I've never seen a quarterback that seems so frantic on every play, and then it just kind of never goes in his direction.
Well, he is Bob Scucci, sportsbook director with Boyd Gaming. Bob, as always, we appreciate the time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So there you go, Phillip Rivers. We talk about the Raiders all the time. It's like, yeah, they're winning way too many one possession games. It's going to regress at some point. I think the Chargers were good last year in one-possession games, and that was it. That's the only time Phillip Rivers has been allowed to have more one-possession wins than losses.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff, brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
Jugando con Mark Stone. Stone con Max Pacioretty. Ahora se tiene el equipo de Vegas Golden Knights al centro, al recentro. Vamos a ver si lo hace. Disparo. Nesmith lo tiene. Disparo. Y el portero nuevamente. ¡Gol!
Me parece que fue Corey Aiken el que la empujó de último.
Corey Glass,
fue Corey Glass el número 9. Señores, lo decíamos, de tanto llegar y llegar y llegar, el gol tenía que caer.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff.
What are you doing? You're blowing the Spanish goal call in the rejoin? People can't appreciate it then. You missed it there. That was Cody Glass's goal from two nights ago. And poor Cody Glass, Herbert Castro tried to give it to Cody Eakin.
Wait, what?
Yeah, you didn't hear that? Herbert Castro said Cody Eakin.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I didn't catch that.
Yeah, because you put in a rejoin. So the Golden Knights play the Sharks tonight. Evander Kane's coming back. He has not played a regular season game against the Golden Knights because he got suspended for the first two. And this will be the first time he plays the Golden Knights and back in Vegas since the Cosmopolitan said that he owes him $500,000. How does that work?
I mean, I think he needs to get to the ice early and he needs to get on the bus as quickly as possible.
Is that how that works? Okay. So Evander Kane will be back and maybe owes the Cosmo $500,000. Maybe not. We'll see. One note on the roster for the Golden Knights. They recalled Nick Waugh last night on an emergency basis. And what that terminology means is that one of their forwards has to be unable to play. But we don't know who it is. The main guess was Alex Tuch, because Alex Tuch was slow to get up off the ice at one point in their game on Tuesday. Granted, he finished the whole game. But according to Ryan the Hockey Guy, Alex Tuch was on the ice this morning, but it was an optional skate. So not everybody was on the ice. You can't really figure out who it is. But conceivably, Nick Waugh is going to play tonight for somebody that is hurt or sick or some other personal issue. But we don't know who. And Gerard Gallant's supposed to talk to the media not too long. Maybe he will say then, maybe not. And you'll just be left everybody staring from the press box during warmups to try to count who's not there. It'll be a fun game. It'll be a fun day in the press box. So we'll see if Nick Waugh's back in. He went to Chicago for one whole game, scored 2 goals. Both in the first period.
All of the players are better in Chicago.
Yeah, it's almost like that's a bad league. Cody Glass, though, he had his first multi-point game of his career against the Maple Leafs. He scored on the power play, also set up a Mark Stone goal. But here's your sort of comparison as to Cody Glass and the rookie class. He has 4 goals and 5 assists. He is top 10 in the rookie class in both goals and assists, and then by default points. He's 9th in the rookie class in ice time this year. So he's, I don't know if you'd say he's in the conversation for Rookie of the Year conversation, the Calder Trophy. Maybe he is, but not quite at the top. It's early, but he does have a decent start. For me, how productive he is the rest of the year is solely dependent on whether or not he plays with Cody Eakin. Cody Glass this year has played 7 games away from Cody Eakin. He has 2 goals and 3 assists in those 7 games. In the 16 games that he was on a line with Cody Eakin, 2 goals, 2 assists.
Okay, yeah.
So almost the same exact production in more than double the games with Eakin than without him. If you look at the advanced stats, his Corsi with Eakin as his center, 48%. With Paul Stastny as his center the last couple of games, 61%. When he was centering Stone, 55%. Expected goals percentage, kind of the same. Eakin, 44%. With Stastny, 65%. With Stone, 55%. Glass is so much more productive when he is not on the ice with Cody Eakin, as is pretty much every other Golden Knight. If he manages to stay with Paul Stastny and Alex Tuch for the rest of the year, there's a good shot he's got an incredible rookie year coming. If they switch the lines back around and it's Cody Eakin and Cody Glass together again, it's probably not going to be a very productive year for Cody Glass. He needs good teammates to be productive. Granted, everyone kind of needs good teammates to be productive. I guess. But at the same time, like, we barely expect Mark Stone to produce with Cody Eakin. So it's not necessarily fair to Cody Glass to say, oh, he can't play with Cody Eakin. He must be a bum. But doesn't need to play with Cody Eakin.
You have 10 seconds. Talk about Cody Eakin's hair.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on there. I don't go to the locker room. I go to the visitor's locker room, so I don't get a good look at his hair. But he's definitely got a mullet. I'm very confused about the bangs. They're almost like Mark Davis bangs.
You suck, Tyler.